Oh, hell no. Like, this is actually my like real life biggest fear. I am, first of all, like already kind of terrified of water because I'm not a very strong swimmer. And there's just like a lot of scary shit in the water. But also, I have learned, I used to think I was claustrophobic, but I've learned that it's actually a restriction of movement that I can't handle. So, like, literally, like all you, the only thing you would have to do is also put like some sort of needle going into my eyeball. And like, those are like my three, like the three worst things that could happen
Great. I mean, I would argue that needle into the eyeball is probably a worst case scenario for most people.
me. I'm Paige.
And I'm Megan.
And this is Spooky Science Sisters.
Hello, you're listening to Spooky Science Sisters, a podcast where we present to you a science-based and probably very giggly discussion on all things strange and unusual.
In this spooky true crime episode, we are going to do a deep dive into some of the crazy events that have taken place at Lake Crescent in Olympic National Park. But first, something spooky. I gotta do something to jazz it up, you know?
I love that that's become a thing.
So, Megan, what spooky stuff happened to you?
So, I don't have anything super spooky to talk about, but I decided today that my something spooky is that I was reading up on body decomposition or the lack thereof in Lake Crescent, which is our topic today, during my lunch break. And it totally put me off my appetite. So that's spooky for me because I love to eat lunch.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for you, but I can say that I don't know that I've ever watched anything or read or heard anything where I was eating and just like had to stop, like just couldn't handle it anymore. I don't know what that says about me because I listen to a lot of true crime podcasts, but here we are.
Yeah, normally it doesn't bother me, but today, when we get to the part that like really got me, I will let you guys know. But yeah, there was just something about it where I was like, ugh, I don't know about this. Okay, so what is your something spooky?
I also don't have anything spooky really, but it is supposed to be negative 30 with wind chill tomorrow. So like that's pretty shitty. Maybe not spooky, but like it freaking sucks.
It's scary for my face when I'm walking the dog tomorrow
Right.
morning.
Exactly, you know.
Yeah. Also spooky for me because reminder, we live in the same city now. Yay.
We did
We did
it.
it. We're gonna celebrate this accomplishment for a while. Okay, so we're talking about Lake Crescent. And to preface this, I did a TikTok series in September and October covering spooky stories from primarily national parks. I did a few city and state parks as well. But one of the parks that I covered is Olympic National Park in Washington. And in my first video on the park, I did two. I talked about the Bigfoot stories from this region, which were fun. But then I found out about and did a video on Lake Crescent and absolutely knew that we had to do a spooky true crime episode focused on it because it's bananas.
It really is. It's like sort of crazy to me that with all of the true crime stuff that I've read, listened to, heard, watched, like I didn't know about this really. I mean, I don't know that I had heard any of these stories.
Neither had I, and they're really good ones. And we will talk about the three main ones today. But yeah, there's just sort of this like, I got the impression from a lot of comments on the TikTok videos that I did that, yeah, there's just sort of this like general spooky vibe about the lake. And it makes people feel rather uneasy. And I think, you know, there have been other people who have gone missing or drowned or, you know, a lot of accidents that have happened. And That's not to say that there's actually anything supernatural or paranormal going on here. It's just it happens to be a very big and deep lake that is very cold, and that sort of makes it inherently dangerous.
Have you been there? Like, have you been to Olympic National Park?
I have been. Yes, I've been to Olympic National Park. I don't remember if we were specifically on Lake Crescent
okay.
when I was there, because I was only there like we only did like a day there. But I mean, it is it's so beautiful.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I looked, I've never been, but I looked at photos of Lake Crescent and I mean, it's beautiful, but a lot of the photos do like even the photos give like a kind of spooky vibe. And part of it, I'm sure, is that, you know, there's like now there are articles about like the spooky stuff that's happened. And so they're picking foggy, spooky photos. But like a lot of the photos right. I saw definitely gave that kind of creepy vibe.
And I mean, some of that's just like it's the Pacific Northwest. It's like,
well, fair.
Parts of Olympic National Park are considered a rainforest and stuff. So it's just sort of a foggy, misty place in general. But yes, it definitely has a reputation. Olympic National Park is beautiful. So this was a super fun one to learn about. And like I said, I knew that we had to do it for an episode. Okay, so we will start with some basic info on the formation of the lake and key characteristics about it. So it was carved by glaciers that covered the area around 14,000 years ago, so during the last glacial maximum. It's similar to Lake Chelan in that way, which is the deepest lake in Washington, but also carved by glaciers. The lake is at least 600 feet deep. The most recent official measurement puts it at 624 feet, but some sources said 650, so it's a little unclear what the true measurement is. But that's sort of part of the mystique of the lake, because there were reports over the years of a survey crew who was laying cable claiming that they reached a depth of 1,000 feet at one point. And of course, there are stories about the lake being bottomless and all these exaggerations about it. So it's, yeah, it's just sort of got a reputation for being this sort of creepy, mysterious place. But even, you know, if the official measurement of 624 or 650, whatever, that's very deep.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that's a lot of water. Okay. So a couple, I guess, interesting things about the lake. So first, there's some really interesting indigenous history about it. So the lake actually used to be part of a larger lake that encompassed the neighboring Lake Sutherland, and the native Klallam and Quileute people, and like, yes, Quileute as in Twilight Quileute. Although I think they don't love to be associated with that.
Wonder why.
Anymore. But they claim that long ago, members of both tribes were killed when Mount Storm King, which is a peak that overlooks both lakes, grew angry at their fighting and threw a huge boulder down at them from its summit and crushed them, killing members of both tribes.
Wow.
Yes. So this is cool because, like, yeah, that just, you know, sounds like sort of a fantastical story. But then geologists have actually found evidence that a massive landslide occurred about 8,000 years ago. So at a time when there were indigenous people already living in the area, that created a dam and cut that pre-existing lake into two parts, forming Lake Crescent and Lake Sutherland. So it's got like a really long history about it from both indigenous people, but then, you know, also from the national park being there and all the people visiting. All right. So the lake is really deep. It is in a mountainous region. It's in the Pacific Northwest. So, you know, it's not really known for being a very warm area, but it is very cold and clear water. There is a remarkably low amount of nitrogen in the water. The lake is classified as what we call, it's classified as ultra oligotrophic, where oligotrophic means that there are very limited nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus. So things that we like artificially put in fertilizers, but that are present in organic materials and soils. So there's very low amounts of these in the lake. So there's not a lot of algae growth or sort of like other little microscopic critters present because they don't have these things to eat. The lake is mainly filled by rain and snowmelt from the surrounding mountains, so it doesn't get a ton of organic laden runoff accumulating in it. This makes the water very clear. You can see down to a depth of about 70 feet, which is pretty awesome. And the chemistry of these types of cold, low nutrient lakes means that bodies don't decompose like they normally would in water. And we're going to talk a lot more about that in a little bit. But yeah, it always brings to mind for me the phrase from the Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald song about Lake Superior, that the lake never gives up its dead. Because Lake Superior, Lake Tahoe, these like very deep, clean, cold lakes are the same way, where it's so cold that bodies just like don't decompose like they normally would. They don't bloat and float to the surface. So it's creepy for that reason alone.
Yeah, absolutely. I like frequently forget how long it takes for a body to decompose in water anyway. Like it already takes quite a bit longer.
Does it? I would have thought it was really fast.
I would have too. And that's why I always forget it. So how quickly does it, hold on.
Ooh, wait, here we go. Differential decomposition in terrestrial, freshwater, and saltwater environments from 2010. Does submersion in water affect decomposition in a way that supports the longstanding generalization that a body decomposing 1 week on the surface of the ground is equivalent to 2 weeks in the water? So it is slower if you're in water versus on the surface of the ground.
Isn't that weird?
That is sort of weird.
It feels backwards to me.
Yeah, but I bet it all comes down to like bugs and scavengers and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, I suppose that you're probably right. So yeah. Anyway.
Okay, well.
I saw a note somewhere about how long it took, and I meant to go back to it and totally forgot. But I just remember being like, oh, that just like takes a lot longer than I would think.
Well, so now we know that bodies decompose slower in water in general. So you learn something new every day. Okay. Okay, so obviously we've gotten to bodies and decomposition and yeah, it's just generally spooky for that reason. But we are going to talk about some specific crimes and how this relates. So the first one we're going to talk about is a woman named Hallie Illingworth. And she's known more often as the Lady of the Lake. And just a warning, if you hadn't caught on by now, we are going to talk about domestic violence in this story. We are going to talk about specifics about body decomposition. So if that makes you uncomfortable, you should just skip this part. Keep going until you get to the 1927 Chevy.
So Hallie Illingworth, she was born in 1901 in Kentucky. As she grew older, she moved away from Kentucky and kind of bounced around the West, spending time in several cities. But after several moves and after ending two marriages, she landed in Washington in 1936. And there she worked as a barmaid at the bar within the Singer's Lake Crescent Tavern, which I guess was actually a whole resort. And the bar is now part of the Lake Crescent Lodge, which is super cool.
Yeah, I know. I was like, I want to go stay there.
Yeah, me too.
vacation.
So in Washington, and actually there at that Crescent Tavern. She meets Montgomery, or Monty, Illingworth, and he was a beer delivery truck driver. And just shortly after meeting, really, that summer of 1936, the two of them get married. Unfortunately, as we've alluded to, Hallie and Monty's marriage goes south pretty quickly. And they get married in 1936, and by the end of 1937, there are already reports of her showing up to work with black eyes, bruises. There's a story where she tells a coworker of hers that he broke her teeth one night. Yeesh. And at some point the police are even called to break up some of their fights. So on December 22nd, 1937, Hallie disappears. And Monty just tells everybody she ran off with another man from Alaska. And while nobody confirms this story, Monty is still granted a divorce the following year. And then he leaves Washington to follow another woman to California who, conveniently, according to some sources, was Hallie's sister's roommate. Because that isn't like super sketchy and weird.
Right. Like, where was Hallie's sister in all this, if that is true? And I do think, like, yeah, it's so suspicious. Like, oh, she disappeared. Like, shoot, guess we'll have to get a divorce now. But I also don't think that it was atypical for the time for people to just take the man at his word. And I'm sure like the whole no body, no crime concept comes into play here.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Just like, like, where is Hallie's sister? She's just like, oh, yeah, my sister is gone.
It's fine. Yeah. Like, they don't, I didn't see anything mentioned like her family launching some big search for her or really, I mean, I'm sure they did. And it just, you know, the headline gets buried under all right. the drama of like, finding her body and everything that happened afterwards.
Right.
But yeah, it's just, it's weird that everyone was just like, yeah, whatever. Like, yeah. Sure, she went to Alaska. Okay. All right. So now we get to the finding of her body. And again, this is the part that is going to get gross and is like for sure the part that put me off my lunch today. So we've been warned.
So I shouldn't be snacking on my peanut M&Ms right now.
No. Although I was eating something soft. Like, I think crunchy is okay. So I can't even think about it. Okay. I don't know why it bothered me so much. Okay. So Hallie's body ends up being found by two fishermen almost 3 years after she went missing. And they find her on July 6th of 1940. And she's found floating in the lake. One source said that it was the first body to ever be found floating in the lake, but that sounds very dramatic. And like, it was 1940. So, you know, that whatever. I don't know if that's true. But her body had been wrapped in a blanket and tied with rope. And it was evident that the restraints had decayed away enough to release her from whatever was used to weigh her down when her body was dumped in the lake. So that's why she was able to float up to the surface. And I mentioned before that because the lake is low in nutrients and very cold, weird things happen to bodies in it. And this was very evident with Hallie's body. So when they unwrapped her, they noted that she was almost perfectly preserved. So some people even described her as like being more of like a statue than a human body, except for she was missing the tips of her extremities. So her tips of her fingers and toes. And her face was also nearly featureless. So, like, she didn't really have a face anymore, which is so fucking terrifying. So she couldn't be identified right away because of those things. And I was like, this is literally Haunting of Bly Manor. Like, what the fuck?
Right. Well, and so I read this note and actually, like, went and looked up to see if Bly Manor was at all, like, credited this story, I guess, at all. And I mean, they didn't, but it is like exactly the same thing.
Yeah, I was just Googling Mike Flanagan because I was like, I wonder if he's from that area or something, like that he would have heard this before.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, he was born in Massachusetts. His dad was in the Coast Guard, so they moved around a lot. So I don't know, maybe he heard the story at some point and it just stuck with him.
Yeah. But
it's just like, it's so uncanny, like some of the details of this. Mm-hmm. Okay. Rather than decomposing in the water like a normal body would, her skin was intact and, or for the most part, intact and had an appearance like that of ivory soap or wax. So what happened is the fatty portions of her body had been converted to a substance called adipocere via a process called saponification, which just means that they were turned into soap. So what happened here is the cold kept her from decomposing and the natural salts and minerals dissolved in the lake water slowly converted her fatty tissue into this soap-like substance.
Okay. So horrifying and like such, yes, a terrible story. So not at, yeah, all to make light of it, but like,
yeah,
it is, it's kind of cool.
Yeah. I mean, the chemistry of it,
yeah, is really awesome.
Is cool. And I mean, ultimately, because she was so well preserved, they were able to tell that she had been murdered. So right. I'm sure it contributed some to her, for them being able to move forward with the case.
And that's sort of like what I was wondering is if she, mm-hmm, had been in any other, you know, or other bodies of water at 3 years, would, mm-hmm, they have been able to identify her?
Right. Yeah. Like, yeah, she might have been so decomposed that they, even if they could identify her, you know, they might not have been able to tell how she had died at, yeah, that point. And so if you can't, you know, if you can't figure that out, then maybe you can't, you know, figure out who did it or if somebody killed her, if it was just an accident, whatever. So, like I said, couldn't identify her right away because she doesn't have a face and she doesn't have the tips of her fingers. But it was very clear, because her skin was so well preserved, that she had been severely beaten and strangled to death. And obviously she was like hogtied and someone had weighted her down before the restraints broke. She did have a very distinctive upper dental plate, which I assume just means like her top bite mark, but I don't know. But investigators took note of this and took pictures of it and sent it around to about 5,000 dentists, wow, in like the area and surrounding states. And it ultimately was identified as Hallie's by a dentist in South Dakota. So I assume she spent some time in South Dakota, or this dentist moved to South Dakota. I'm not sure, but they must have treated her and taken x-ray images in the past and like noted that she had this very distinctive dental plate. At this point, they know she's been murdered. They know who she is. They know she's gone missing, and her husband has like fucked off to California, being like, "Oh, I don't know where she is." So Monty gets charged with Hallie's murder and arrested and extradited to Washington for his trial. And of course, he's claiming that he was innocent, and he denies that the corpse was even Hallie's. But the dental records obviously are very difficult to disprove. But really the sort of nail in his proverbial coffin was that they were able to match fibers from the rope she was tied with to one that Monty had borrowed several years earlier from either a storekeeper, or I saw a couple sources say the resort owner at the Lake Crescent Tavern.
That's insane.
Yeah.
That is insane.
Yeah. So it's like, it's just crazy that they were able to match those and figure out that they were the same. So they do this. They've got the dental records. It's obviously very suspicious in the first place. Like you said, he was found guilty. I think I read that it only took the jury like 4 hours to come back with a verdict. So it was very quick. Mm-hmm. And he got convicted for life. But as these things go, he only ended up serving 9 years of his sentence before he got paroled and was able to move back to California. So fuck that guy. Okay. So, you know, Hallie's body, I mean, it's like you said, like, it's very sad. Like, you feel for her. She's in this bad marriage and she gets murdered and everything. But like, it is sort of a very cool, like, oh, we use this pretty neat science to like solve this murder and end up, you know, arresting and convicting Monty for it. But the stories don't end there. So a lot of people claim that Hallie is still around. And it was before she was identified that news stories started calling her the Lady of the Lake. But that has stuck. Many people think that she haunts the Lake Crescent Lodge, causing mischief, like she bangs on doors in the middle of the night and flickers lights on and off. Some people have even claimed to see her glowing figure floating across the surface of the water. And I had a couple people who worked at the lodge or had worked there who commented on TikTok saying that it was like, it was well known that, you know, Hallie was supposed to be around the lodge, but they sort of made it sound like she was, you know, the consensus was that she was sort of this like benevolent spirit hanging out.
Greetings from Evergreen Podcasts. We're rolling out a listener survey and we want to hear from you. The information in the survey will help us gather statistics and in turn make our shows more appealing to advertisers. I know most people don't like ads, but this is one of the only ways our shows make money and help keep their lights on. We promise it will only take a few minutes, but the impact on our podcasts will be tremendous. As a token of our appreciation, we'll randomly select one lucky participant each month to win an exclusive merchandise package from Evergreen Podcasts. Head to evergreenpodcast.com/listenersurvey to help a show and possibly get some free stuff for doing so. We can't thank you enough for the support. Now back to the show.
So the second story we're going to talk about, which like...
It's slightly less gruesome.
It's less gruesome, yeah. But like also I think that the next two stories are significantly less scientific as well. So just join us for this chat about true crime.
Yeah. This one's got DNA testing at the end.
That's
a spoiler that's alert, fair. But you know, anyway. Yeah. Go ahead.
But you don't know what the results are, so nothing spoiled. We are going to talk about Russell and Blanche Warren. So Blanche, 33 years old, had been at the Port Angeles Hospital. And on July 3rd, she was discharged. So
in 1929, by the way. Did we talk about that yet?
I was about to.
Okay.
But that's fine. So Russell goes and picks her up after she's been discharged. And the two of them head back to their home by, I already forgot how to pronounce this, by the Bogachiel River.
Yeah.
And they're going home to their sons to celebrate 4th of July.
Yeah. Like, yay, mom's out of the hospital.
Yeah.
We're going home to celebrate the holiday.
Hang out. Unfortunately, though, the two of them never make it home.
Mm.
So 2 weeks later, the couple's announced missing. And I think there's like some, you know, there's got to be some amount of searching going on in those 2 weeks. But I just didn't find a ton of information about it. But after they're announced missing, it sparks a 2-month police investigation. And that police investigation, unfortunately, doesn't really find much. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of theories surrounding what's happened and why they've disappeared. Many speculate that the couple missed a turn or like a curve in the road, which would have sent their car into Lake Crescent, resulting in the Warrens drowning.
Yes. And during that search, I just wanted to note that they did do a search of the water in the area where they suspected that the car may have gone off the road. But with the diving technology of the time, they couldn't go very deep. I think it was like they couldn't even go deeper than about 70 feet. And this is like, you know, in a lake that gets very deep very fast. So it's, you know, they didn't find the Warrens. They didn't find the car or anything. So unfortunately, their sons and the rest of their family didn't get any closure. And this is such a sad story because they left their two sons, Frank and Charles, behind, who were either – it's like they're either 11 and 13 or 12 and 14 at the time, but fairly young. And a lot of people were saying that the Warrens had just abandoned their sons, you know, just, you know, cut and run because they didn't want to take care of them anymore. And so that was really hard on the boys. I guess they were teased and like didn't have any way to disprove the rumors that their parents had abandoned them. So yeah, it's rough times.
Yeah, I had read, and I don't know at what ages, but I believe it was Charles. One of them, I don't remember which, one of them died from a drowning accident.
Seriously?
Weirdly enough, yeah.
That is weird.
And then the other one I don't think he lived to be very old because he had succumbed to alcohol addiction. So
yikes.
Very sad story.
Yeah. You said. I definitely heard the problems with alcohol. And yeah, I mean, I think the one story I read sort of said that a lot of it stemmed from they just had so many problems after this happened. So
yeah,
it's such a bummer. So anyway.
So yeah, very sad. Fortunately, you know, unfortunately, it's a little too late, I think, for the family. But fortunately, at some point, 72 years later, Bob Caso, who is a former diver, he renews the search with Dan Pontbriand, who's an Olympic National Park Ranger. The two of them get together and renew the search. And Bob has done decades of his own research into the case prior to even trying to get Dan on board. So the two of them, like I said, are back on the case. And after an 11-month search, a team of divers finally find the Warren's Chevy at the bottom of Lake Crescent.
Yeah. So this is this like over 70-year-old cold missing persons case. There we go. The car was found around in about 170 feet of water near a location called Ambulance Point, which is called that because an ambulance once slid off the road there when it was icy and two EMTs in it escaped, but the patient who was strapped to the gurney drowned, which is a fucking nightmare all on its own.
Yeah. Oh, hell no. Like, this is actually my, like, real life biggest fear.
Yeah.
I am, first of all, like, already kind of terrified of water because I'm not a very strong swimmer. And there's, just, like, a lot of scary shit in the water. But also, I have learned, I used to think I was claustrophobic, but I've learned that it's actually a restriction of movement that I can't handle.
Okay.
So, like, literally, like the only thing you would have to do is also put like some sort of needle going into my eyeball. And like, those are like the three worst things that could happen to me.
Great. I mean, I would argue that needle into the eyeball is probably a worst case scenario for most people. But yeah, I mean, it's just like this is the thing about Lake Crescent. It's just like, there are all these stories that are just, I mean, they're tragic and like just some of the strangest stories. Like, and yeah, like apparently the patient too, like I think they just had like a broken leg or a broken arm or something like that, survivable injury. And it's like, cool. So you're in the ambulance, you're on the way to the hospital, and then it's like you fucking drown. The worst. Anyway.
I will say that like, yes, there are some like weird stories coming from this lake, but like I would imagine that a lot of bodies of water have similar stories. I mean, like I'm sure that not every water's like, oh, the patient on a gurney drowned, but like I'm sure every body of water has like a list of weird stories that happen there. So like you said earlier, like probably like nothing paranormal is going on here.
Yeah,
it's just like these ones are like a little weird.
Yeah, they've had like some higher profile things happen, and then people really pay attention to it at that lake. So it makes it seem like more is happening. But like, yeah, realistically, I know like there have been tons of shipwrecks on the Great Lakes, like Lake Superior has a ton of spooky stories. Yeah, there's a ton of stuff about various large bodies of water and large lakes, and Crater Lake has its own set of spooky stories about the lake and stuff. So yes, I know that it's probably overblown, but it is, it's like, it's easy to sort of get carried away, swept up into it, because like there are just some really creepy stories about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and it's, it's like we talked about, I think this was last episode that we recorded. I said like, oh, basically like all large bodies of water probably have dead bodies in them. So like at some point we've decided like there's
a certain number of dead bodies that we're okay to with. Water
ratio that people are okay with.
Do you think it's the number of body, like do you think it's a ratio or do you just think there's just like a number of bodies? Like it doesn't matter what body of water I'm in. If there's 100 bodies or less, I'm fine.
Okay, but if you're in like a swimming pool and there's 100
I'm just being a jackass.
Okay. Anyway, back to the Warrens. Okay. So, yeah, like Paige said, like it's, you know, a little too late for their sons, but they do have surviving family members. And in 2004, skeletal remains were found not too far from where their car was located. And they were later able to be tested for DNA. And it was confirmed by comparing the DNA to one of their surviving relatives that it belonged to Russell Warren. So the good news is, yes, this took a long time, but we do get some closure about what happened to them. And it sort of sounded like, you know, even in these surviving family members, like it's a family story that's gotten passed down for a long time. So I'm sure they still got some sense of relief, you know, knowing what actually happened. I think the only thing that stuck out to me about this was like, oh, like, I mean, he's, you know, been in there for over 70 years. I think he is down to just skeleton because this is in shallower water. So we're like in like 150 feet of water versus... It must have been that Hallie was like much deeper down or dumped in a deeper part of the lake. Because I think like with Hallie's body and the saponification, like if the body stays deep enough, like I think it just stays that way, like indefinitely. So
yeah.
We're on to our last major thing about Lake Crescent. Our last major spooky true crime.
Yes. So now we're going to talk about Israel Keyes.
And had you heard about Israel Keyes before this?
No, I didn't hear about, I hadn't heard of any of these.
Right?
This is all new
to me. Okay, so this was new as well. I had not heard about him either. And then like, since I did the TikTok and like included a little blurb about him, I've gone on to listen to like a couple podcast episodes about him. And there's like a serialized one that I'm planning to listen to. But yeah, like he, in terms of serial killers, I'm like, A, surprised that neither of us had heard of him. And like, B, he's one of the more terrifying ones to me.
Definitely. Definitely.
He's a real shitbag.
Yes. Super shitbag. Israel is a former U.S. soldier who lived in the Nea Bay area from 2001 until about 2007. And in 2007, he moves to Anchorage, Alaska, where he opens a construction company.
And is Nea Bay also in Alaska?
No, that's in Washington. It's about, I think it's like 100 miles away from Lake Crescent.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so he's living in that general area. And so on March 13th of 2012, Israel is arrested for the kidnapping and murder of a 17-year-old barista. And her age sort of changes depending on the source you're looking at. Some I saw said 16, some said 18, but she's somewhere in that range. And her name is Samantha Koenig, and she is like literally kidnapped from the coffee cart that she is working at. Now, it's important to note that a lot of the information regarding how many crimes Israel has committed in what years and in which order, it's all a little bit confusing. Mm-hmm. It sounds like, as Megan stated, he's a shitbag and he isn't very forthcoming with any of the names of his victims. Yeah. And he like seems to enjoy messing with the police.
Yeah.
So it makes it kind of hard and it makes the reporting of his crimes like sort of messy.
Yeah. I sort of got the sense that there's like, yeah, he's got some sort of like narcissistic personality disorder thing my going on. Well. But like he had a wife and a kid and stuff like that. So it's just, he's just living this like insane double life. But anyway, go ahead.
Oh, fine. So mostly that it's just important to keep that in mind. All the information I have on Israel is just my attempt to piece together everything that I had gotten from several sources. A lot of them are conflicting. So just like I said, keep in mind that it isn't clear what things he was being honest about, and therefore the information we have may not perfectly match other tellings of his crimes. So according to some of the information that was compiled on Wikipedia, they state he left Samantha's body in a shed and went to New Orleans, where he departed on a pre-booked two-week cruise with his family in the Gulf of Mexico. When he returns to Alaska, he removes Koenig's body from the shed, applies makeup to her, to her face, sews her eyes open with fishing line, and snaps a picture of a four-day-old issue of the Anchorage Daily News alongside her body, posed to appear that she was still alive. He then demands $30,000 in ransom, and then he dismembers her body and disposes of it in Matanuska Lake, north of Anchorage. And while this is a tragic story, unfortunately, it's not the only story like this. So during the FBI's investigation, they come to find out that Israel is involved in several other killings. Now, he admits to, and this number, like I said, changes depending on what source you read, mm-hmm. but somewhere around another 7 murders, but the FBI thinks it's possible that he could have been involved in up to 11 other killings. Mm-hmm. So according to their timeline, Keyes commits his first crime while he is living in Nia Bay. So while he is in Washington mm-hmm. State, they think is when he commits his first homicide. And he apparently says to the FBI while they're questioning him that he committed his first murder because his town was boring.
Ugh.
Because apparently murder is the answer to solving your boredom.
Fucking asshole. And I think what also makes him particularly terrifying is that he was committing these murders all over the country. So like Samantha Koenig is like in Anchorage where he was, but like he used to apparently fly to different places and like bury or hide these basically like murder caches, and then come back later and just like pick a random victim and take them to where the cache was and murder them, which is just insane. Like there just wasn't any pattern to who he chose.
Yeah, it was like totally random victims. And then in one of the interviews I had read, they were talking about like what weapons he would use. Mm-hmm. And like even that, I mean, he didn't have one in particular, though apparently at some point did state that like using a gun was his last resort, whatever that means. But he just, yeah, super random, like all over the place. And he then tells FBI agents that he supposedly disposes of this body that he murders in the Nia Bay area. And he disposes of it by dumping it into Lake Crescent and weighing it down with 4 to 5 milk jugs. And like in these interviews, he apparently states at one point that he disposed of the bodies. So unclear if there's just one or if there's several or if these even happened at all.
So yeah, that's how we get back to Lake Crescent. With Israel Keyes, yeah. Is that he claims that he was dumping bodies there. And he ended up taking his own life while he was imprisoned. So I don't think he ever even got brought to trial or anything. So
yeah, I think it was like pretty shortly after those interviews that he did.
Yeah. So it's a bummer all around. But yeah, just like another weird, creepy thing connected to Lake Crescent. But like we said, you know, I'm sure there are other bodies being dumped in other large lakes as well. It's just that people pay particular attention when it is Lake Crescent. Okay, so final thoughts before we wrap up. So it is thought, and I think this is legit, that there is an underground stream that flows from Lake Crescent to Lake Sutherland. And if you'll remember, they were cut off from one another by this large landslide that occurred about 8,000 years ago, but that they're still connected by some sort of like underground conduit. And Dr. Charles P. Larson, who is a pathologist from Tacoma who worked on Halley's body in the 1940s, estimated that you would probably find 50 to 100 bodies in that channel all turned to soap. So
great.
Yikes. But if you want to hear more about this, or you are interested in more spooky or true crime stories about national parks, A, you can follow me on TikTok because I have like 20 videos on there than I did in September and October. And I will be doing more this September and October. But there's also this great podcast called National Parks After Dark. And their whole thing is they like tell spooky stories and true crime stories that happen in national parks. And they're really great. So I highly recommend that you check that out.
Okay. Well, that wraps up our spooky true crime episode on Lake Crescent. It's such a joyful episode this was.
We've had like two episodes for the beginning of the year that have ended on just like severe bummers.
Yeah, right.
These have been probably like our least giggly episodes because we're just like totally horrified the whole time.
Hopefully, when you tune in to episode 42 on the Winchester Mansion or the Winchester Mystery House, it will be a little less dark and sad.
It might not be.
But it honestly probably won't be.
It's that time of year, you guys. We all need more vitamin D to be giggly.
If you liked this episode, hit subscribe and share with a friend. You can find us on TikTok at Spooky Science, Twitter and Instagram at Spooky SciPod, Facebook at Spooky Science Sisters, and at our website, SpookyScienceSisters.com. If you have any questions about previous topics or ideas for future episodes, email us at SpookyScienceSisters@gmail.com. As always, thank you for listening and stay spooky.
Science! 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 Hello, podcast fans. Want to get weird with us? Come check out the Mad Scientist Podcast. We are a weekly show that looks at the history, philosophy, and hard facts behind your biggest paranormal questions.
Did the government really pay for a psychic spy program?
Yes!
Is it true that surgery got its start in grave robbing?
Yes!
Can a roller coaster really kill you?
Legally, we can't say so for sure, but sometimes, yes! Join myself, Chris Cogswell, and my co-host, Marie Mayhew, as we examine the science, philosophy, and history behind the strange and unusual. All to discover what's possible and plausible versus what's, well, just made up. Check us out wherever you find your favorite podcasts. The Mad Scientist Podcast.